Welcome back to Pax Europiana, the podcast about peace in Europe and about the EU days. And this one is very much about peace and a special day in European history. It's about the 12th of February and 2015, the so-called Minsk II agreement. And I want to devote this day to on the 12th of February 2015. Always think about the Minsk II agreement and what it meant for Europe, what it means today for Europe. And it needs to be understood in the context that this was the first European effort in peacemaking since the Second World War without major American involvement, leadership, and actually the first one which was not led by America since 1945, obviously. And it led to very dodgy and shabby results. Yeah. Without America, unfortunately, this effort led by France and Germany is a typical example for what is happening when peace is made by these two medium-sized regional powers in Europe. Because without American firepower and leadership and global standing and the capacities which America brings up, obviously, it's very difficult to confront Russia, which is a much bigger power. It is the same size like France and Germany united, and it has, of course, much more political united leadership and also much more military assets than France and Germany. And so this is a major issue. Without America, Europe cannot make peace, sustainable peace, and has to make very soft forms of compromises with Russian aggression. And that's exactly what happened in Minsk. Let me come back, you know, what is Minsk in general? Because it's a bit confusing, it's always called Minsk. Minsk, what is the capital of Belarus? But the main story, obviously, is that this was, in a way, the neutral meeting ground between Ukraine and Russia, and where the Europeans could go as well. It unfortunately had a negative side effect also to legitimize this dictatorship of the Belarusian dictator Lukashenko as a kind of legitimate peacemaker, which absolutely he is not. He is a hostile state and he is a Russian proxy, but anyhow, he hopefully will be losing power soon. But nevertheless, that was one of the sad side effects, yeah. Because it was seen useful to have his, in a way, support, because in this heavy fighting years of 2014 and 15, it was seen as a necessary compromise. Anyhow, yeah, exactly, it was heavy fighting. Let's never forget what Russia did in 2014 and 15 as a response to the pro-European turn of Ukraine with the Euromaidan. It decided to punish the Ukrainian state and nation by taking two regions. Most important for Russia, obviously, was the Crimea, and that's a small peninsula which in the February 2014 was then a military in a coup retaken by Russia. Retaken, I say, because obviously it was also part of the Soviet Union, everything. And there was, of course, you know, a lot of military assets and attached to the military assets of Russia and the Soviet Union, which Russia inherited out of whatever reason. But Russia, that was the way the Soviet Union was split up. And then basically with this military personnel, there came a lot of Russian military personnel with the military bases. And so this led to Crimea being quite strongly pro-Russian also in the first independence referendum in 91. It was already quite support. It was a majority for independence, but it was the weakest region with Ukrainian identity already back then. And Russia obviously knew it. And Ukraine is the most strategic asset. Crimea is the most strategic asset in the Black Sea, with the control of the Black Sea, with this famous harbor of Sevastopol. So basically, it was rather easy for Russia to take this peninsula. And by the way, it was illegal. It was then later annexed. We will never recognize it. And it was a shattering event for the geopolitical structure of the free world and of the world in itself on the 27th of February 2014. I will talk in a separate video about this very dramatic event. So what happened then was basically that Russia decided to need also a land bridge towards Crimea and to see if this kind of, in a way for Russia, the success of the Crimea annexation can be repeated also in the south coast of Ukraine. And they tried it in Odessa, in Kherson. These are the southern regions of Ukraine at the Black Sea. And, you know, they were only successful to some extent in this region, which is called Donbass. I have to explain the history of Donbass in a nutshell. It's a coal basin. It's an industrial area comparable to the Saar or to the Ruhr area in, to this Rhine region in Germany. And it is of major significance for the Soviet defense industry. And because of the coal reserve, it was industrialized already in the later part of the 19th century. People from all over Soviet Union were sent there to live there. So they have no kind of traditional cultural roots with Ukraine in that sense. And there was a very small, loose and weak identity of Ukraine built for that reason, basically. And it is a kind of a region where these big industrial complexes led to a lot of environmental pollution, but also the structure is very much a classical Soviet industrialized structure. You have big industrial combinats, and the people are loyal to their company because they eat there, they live there, they get paid there, they work in this context of these big steel and coal companies. And it's also famously for corruption, oligarchization, and it's basically owned by a few big oligarchs, most of these industrial assets. So the whole region was always, also in Ukraine, collusive, corruptive kind of center of criminality, and it is a very problematic region also in the time when it was with Ukraine. And it is legally with Ukraine. But I want to explain the context of that region. And it borders also to the Russian Federation. So logistically, it was easy to be supplied and easy to be supported. And all this kind of, in a way, rebellion, if you want, was from the beginning started from the Russian Federation as a revenge to the what the Russians see as a betrayal by the Ukraine to signing with the European Union, the free trade deal, the DCFTA, making the revolution and ousting Yanukovych. Yanukovych, by the way, is the quintessential Ukrainian Donbass oligarch. He comes from that region. So basically came the DCFTA in Vilnius. You might remember the Eastern Partnership Summit in November, the protests in Ukraine against Yanukovych not signing this agreement, which he always promised to sign. And then the option of Russia to have this big loan and also then joining the Eurasian Economic Union, Putin's favorite anti-EU union project and the copy of the EU in the East. And then the people protesting because the Ukrainians in general see themselves as Europeans. And they are Europeans. They didn't want to be in a Russian-led Eurasian Union and they understood what is at stake. Then there was all this escalation of violence during the protests by the authorities of Yanukovych against the people in Kiev. And then there was the basic escalation then in January 2014 and the flight of Yanukovych with all his money towards Donbass and then to Ukraine and to Russia. And then happened this annexation and all this manipulation of Crimea. And then the second escalation point was obviously the start of the Donbass War. In a short way, it is important to understand that Ukraine was in a political turmoil as well and had to find its own political structures. There was the flight of Yanukovych. This has the necessity to have some first presidential election, and that happened only in May 2014, on the 25th of May. And so it took some time for the new Ukraine, if you want, the free European Ukraine, to consolidate. And this from basically the revolution in February to May, it took 3 months to consolidate. And in this time, the Russian-backed separatists, they could make some inroads, obviously. But the moment then on the in end of May, when the Ukrainian authorities mobilized and were consolidated, basically there started the second phase. After the initial loss of cities like Mariupol in the east, also a lot of parts of Donbass were then taken over by this armed revolutionaries backed by Russia. And then came the rollback. President Poroshenko basically started the big rollback. He got back together with his military forces and also with volunteer battalions. He got back Mariupol and he started a big rollback campaign into the in the Donbass. Understand as well, it was not possible to really do the same in Crimea. Crimea is much more complex geographically. There's only a small isthmus, and also there was much more Russian military already there. So that was the reason it was technically very hard to reconquer Crimea. So the efforts were first done in eastern Donbass to take basically back Mariupol. That's an important seaport. And then also Donetsk and all these other cities. And this was quite a successful campaign. So the time from June 2014 to the mid of August was basically the Ukrainian initiative. The army, which was, and this is also important to understand, that Ukraine, as part of the Soviet Union, all defense efforts were obviously directed against Europe. So most of the military installations of Ukraine have been traditionally in Western Ukraine, because the idea was, obviously we never wanted that, but the idea was that there will be the attack from the West into Ukraine, and so the military installation were there. And obviously also Ukraine was very, you know, they were not well organized there. And there was a lot of corruption, problems of mobilization. It took some time. But then this was basically settled with the new president. And then the war really was going in the favor of Ukraine. And Ukraine would have most likely driven out all these separatist and Russian proxies out of all of Donbass by the summer of 2014. The campaign was going very good, but the campaign was in a way going too good, because how it went, it was like this, that then Russia massively intervened to avoid a complete defeat of Ukraine and of the Russian-backed forces. Yeah? And so basically it happened, because then came this big battle on the end of August, this Loviansk battle, which was a major defeat of Ukraine, and Russia basically could consolidate and start again the third phase, in a sense, the reconquest of Donbass. So the battle was waging that way. Again, I explain. First in May, June, April to June, April to the end of May, and the takeover of much of this territory by Ukrainian, by Russian separatists. And then came the reconquest of Ukraine, of its territory, almost completely. See that the Loviansk battle is already quite close to the Ukrainian-Russian battle. So, but then came, unfortunately, in the time Russia massively intervened, and that led also to a lot of reaction. First of all, Russia has never conceded in the public that it really intervened, but there was a lot of military people and also a lot of casualties, and that was in the framework of the international situation. It was the Wales summit in September 2014, and there was the moment when then the NATO has decided to have 2%, and obviously the leaders were totally shell-shocked by the events. There was a real tank battles again in Europe. It was very dramatic. And obviously Russia was bent to really military intervene. And that led to the first Minsk agreement, the first Minsk agreement. That was on the 5th of September. And that was a desperate try by the Germans and the French to stop the Russian reconquest of eastern Ukraine. And it really had no effect at all. Basically, it was signed, but then the fighting escalated, and basically Russia did ignore it completely. And the battles were really very hard then from September to January. September to January, basically to February. Then after Minsk, it was such a successful under brackets, armistice, and that basically it required a second Minsk. And also it was making the international community and Europe, because America was not involved. And I wonder why. I come to that in a moment. Yeah. But to understand this, in a way, the third phase after Minsk one was completely ignored. There was basically a huge Russian offensive, yeah, which led to the capture of Donetsk in January. And the fall of, that's quite famous, the Donetsk airport. And it was luckily possible to defend Mariupol. And that is also the main outcome. Donetsk was lost, Mariupol was won. And that is basically then the situation ever since. Let me come to the idea of Normandy format, because that's an important context in that to understand. Normandy, everybody in the world would understand Normandy as something led by the Americans and British, because it was the American and British, and also some Polish actually, to liberate Europe from the Nazis in Western Europe on the famous 6th of June 44. But unfortunately, that was not what Normandy is about. Yeah? Normandy is a format where they met in Normandy for the celebration of D-Day 75, and it is only for France and Germany. France, basically, you remember, that was the defeated power, which was a collaboratist regime, and which then later was, for political reasons, granted allied status. And it is basically this France, and it's Germany, which was the aggressor of World War II, obviously. And these two powers, now in the European Union, and they took the liberty to call themselves Normandy format, together with Ukraine and Russia, and thinking that they can make peace in this conflict, which was, in a way, a World War I kind of battle in Eastern Europe between Ukraine and Russia. And no Britain. I cannot understand, if anybody has the reason, it must be connected with this great withdrawal which Obama did in August 2013, because somehow he was missing in action on that one, and it led to that effect that, of course, without American firepower, without American backing, the only thing the Europeans are able, militarily, politically, strategically, is to buy Russia into a kind of consensus, because there is no military threat level we can do. And the only thing we can do is we can offer things like Nord Stream 2, or we can tell Ukraine we will not support you. So we can weaken Ukraine and to somehow buy Ukraine or force Ukraine into a compromise. And we can buy Russia into economic deals. But we have no military threat level. And we have also nothing else as leverage, in a sense. So we are in a very weak position. And Germany and France were in a very weak position. But obviously, they tried to, with the best intention, to stop the bloodshed. And so the focus is only to stop the bloodshed. Nothing strategically matters anymore. Just to find a way for Russia to be stopping its tanks and not invading all of Ukraine in a way. Which is good, you know, as a very basic compromise, it's understandable. But with American leadership, we could have achieved much more. And please, America, don't let Europe to the Europeans, because then we will always have these kind of outcomes. So let me remind that in the meantime, it's also very important to understand that in July was this shoot down of MH17, the Malaysian airline from Netherlands to Malaysia, which was shot down over Ukrainian airspace by a Russian military advanced technology rocket, which the separatists had because Russia gave it to them, otherwise they wouldn't have had it. And they thought that they will shoot down a Ukrainian airline. They didn't have this competence to make the difference between civilian airline and Ukrainian airlines. And they had this very sophisticated weapon, this Buk, and they shot down this MH17, and 300 Europeans and Malaysians, they died. And they died also, and we have to see, this is also the product of the European appeasement, because normally when there is a war declared, you close the civilian airspace above. You close the airspace above a war zone for civilian airplanes in order to save them, because there can always be a rocket around. Yeah? And this is what much of the Balkans until recently was still military closed airspace, even 20 years after the war. So the Ukrainian airspace was not closed, and these poor people were, without them knowing, flying over Ukraine. They had no idea. These were mostly Malaysians and Dutch who had no idea about where they were flying. They were just wanting to go to Malaysia. But they all died tragically on this day in July 2014. Also, we are very much co-responsibility. Also, obviously, the main responsibility is with Putin, who has supplied this weapon and who has started that war. So let me also mention in the context, it's very important that the Austrians, they have invited Putin in June to the visit of shame to Vienna, where he was famously greeted with the red carpet at the moment when all this war was escalating and the Donbass war was in full swing. And then he was coming to Vienna to make some Nord Stream 2 deal. Yeah? Let's not forget that was very important. And we will see the context of the energy business in the form of this podcast. Yeah? That was in June. And then in the summer, the escalation, the battle of, it's a bit complicated, but the battle of Lovnyatsk, that is basically in the end of August, the big defeat of Ukraine in the reconquest of Donbass by Russia. And this is basically the 29th of August. Yeah? Over 1,000 Ukrainians died in that battle. Then came the Wales summit, and then came the Minsk summit. Then it failed. And then these 4 months were the main phase of the conquest of Eastern Donbass by Russia happened. And with the only real success of Ukraine is that it was possible to defend Mariupol, which is such an important city. And it has ended then in the 12th of February, Minsk 2, where desperate Germany, desperate France tried to bring Russia again to the negotiation table. It worked. And to some extent, it worked. It must also be recognized that the battle zones, this kind of demarcation line between occupied, Russian-occupied Eastern Donbass and Free Donbass are quite clear today, and they have not changed in major dimensions since then. You know, obviously, you have to understand that it's important that on 12th of February this was signed, but Russia felt obliged to still make a major attack on Ukrainian forces, and this is this famous battle of Debaltseve. And that was basically after Minsk was signed on the 12th. The week after, Russia used its forces on the ground still drive out all Ukrainian forces from the territory it wanted to have. And it killed another hundreds of people basically in the Battle of Debaltseve. So that is the last major battle on the Ukrainian Russian war of 2014 and 15. But imagine how badly this deal was done, because not any kind of clear armistice was the result. Yeah? Since then, hundreds of soldiers have been lost, maybe thousands, yeah? Because the fighting and the artillery shelling and the brutality at the border zone continues to this day. Now we are 21. So that means 6 years after, because now it's the 6th anniversary, or whatever kind of sad anniversary of the of this Minsk II agreement. Some people, of course, can say, and I understand that, you can say, at least, you know, the Russian progress was stopped. Good, fine, yeah. That's exactly what we can do in Europe. We can buy Russia, we have some energy deals, and with some concessions into at least not conquering all Ukraine. Yeah, that's maybe a success if you see it like this. Yeah, but we cannot really ask Russia to leave Ukraine. We have no capacities for doing that. And we are proud that we then had a very complicated Minsk II agreement, which was at least stopping the war in a sense of not having any kind of major tank battles anymore. And that we see as a success. Now, yeah, in some ways, it's some success. Yeah, you know, I want to concede that. Yeah, it's a complicated situation. Huh? But the complicated situation was from the start, yeah, because Russia was starting this war with the intent to undermine Western integration of Ukraine and punish Ukraine for having this audacity to sign an agreement with the European Union. And then we cannot protect countries which want to do that. Yeah? And we celebrate it as a great progress for peace when we stop the Russian tank columns going to Kiev. Yeah? Okay, you can see it like this, but it's not a very proud position to have, and it's not a very great thing to be proud of. And then we sign things in this agreement like Ukraine should be neutral again. I mean, countries which were just aggressed by other countries, and 7% of their territory and 5 million of their people were basically occupied by Russia in a war of aggression. And then you force this nation into some kind of neutrality and in a federalization, because I'm very much for federalization. But when it's a federalization which is basically meant to make impossible Western integration, but also make a federalization where the regions then dominate foreign policy. And that's not the federalization, that's not a federal Ukraine. That's a non-working, dysfunctional Ukraine. So what I say, it's basically, it's a very mixed blessing, this 12th of February. It has led to a stabilization of the front line, but it's not an armistice. It's not a peace plan. It's just a stabilization. It's kind of just a way to stop the Russian tank columns going further. That's some progress. That's some success, but it's not really something to be very proud of. Yeah. And that Minsk II is the formula for peace or even for an armistice. Yeah? It's obviously proven wrong because there is no peace and there is no armistice. Yeah? And there is no goodwill. And the whole effect which the Donbass war from the beginning should have, that it makes the life for Ukraine very difficult as a European Ukraine, is achieved in a sense. Yeah? Because there is no invitation for Ukraine to join the EU or NATO in a sense. Yeah? And the Germans and French have always blocked it. And there is this agreement for Nord Stream 2. Because it's not a coincidence that on the 12th of February 2015, Minsk 2 was signed, and on the 18th of June, just 4 months later, was the signing of Nord Stream 2. Because that was really the price for Minsk 2, and also the way to persuade Putin to order the stop of further progress. In the meantime, actually, it's totally changed because Ukraine is much more developed militarily. But at that time, it would have been possible that Russia would have maybe gained more territory. So that's exactly the complicated 12th of February I want everybody to remember. And I want to understand that when you see it to the American peace, for example, in 1995, Holbrooke in Dayton, he made a much better and more, working armistice. After 95, there was no fighting anymore in Bosnia. There was a lot of fighting after the armistice in Minsk too. Not at least the Battle of Delbatseve, but continuously to this day, there's artillery duels and there is this continuing rebel activity. And there are people dying to this day, and not to talk, you know, that the conditions of Donbass, of occupied Donbass, are really horrible in all aspects, in the aspects of environment, breakdown of social order, immigration, and it's a disaster zone, which even Russia has no intention to settle, because they have never had the intention to annex it, like in Crimea and also in West. And I have talked already about the care obligation. The Russians, to some extent, they really care for Crimea. In a way, they invest there, they build infrastructure. They do a lot of human rights violations, which they shouldn't as a Council of Europe member. But the intention in Eastern Donbass was never to integrate it fully or to recognize it as a state, but always to leave it at the gigantic, bleeding, open wound to make the life of Ukraine and the people who have decided a European future, to make it as difficult as possible. And that's why they keep this kind of armistice violations going every day, just as a gigantic reminder for the crime of choosing Europe and for the Europeans that Russia is very dangerous. Yeah? So basically, it's a gigantic threat, constant open wound, which is opened. And that was the whole purpose of the whole operations. It was never something nice meant for the people of Donbass. Yeah? It was never planned to integrate it and develop it. Yeah? It was always meant to be a zone of destruction, open wound, and of disaster, and to make the life of the Europeans and the Ukrainians very, very, very complicated. And in some ways, unfortunately, that's the tragic legacy of Minsk II. There was no settlement which would really work in any way. It was just the Europeans were happy, the tanks stopped, and in some ways the tanks stopped. They're not progressing in direction of Kiev. That's a great success then for European diplomacy. It's a diplomacy of weakness, it's a diplomacy of appeasement, it's a diplomacy of disaster, in my view, and I really don't like it. So, anyhow, nevertheless, it's a complicated legacy. Remember on the 12th of February, the Minsk II agreement. Understand, it's not even an armistice. It's not a peace agreement. It's no road to peace. It's just, you know, a kind of stopping the worst of Russian aggression. And it has led to misery for these 3.5 million people which still live under terrible conditions in Russian-occupied Donbass. And there is no real kind of way forward. And as I said, it's very tragic, but also now we can do very little for them because ultimately they live under Russian obligation. So what needs to be done is to focus much more on free Ukraine and get free Ukraine in NATO, EU, adopt the euro and make sure the people in free Ukraine have a better life. And over time, unity will come back again once the prosperity differential is big enough. And that's the only way to settle this, because without American leadership, we are not able to confront Russian aggression in Eastern Europe. Hopefully, there will be better times, but that's how I see it. So please remember the 12th of September, of the 12th of February 2015, always as a very complicated day, as a day at least, you know, there was no further Russian aggression, but a lot of Ukrainians have paid with their life immediately afterwards, and then also continuously in the last 6 years. And this is not what we can be proud about. Yeah. On the contrary, Minsk II, in my view, is a debacle. It has maybe hindered something worse, yeah, and protected us from a complete disaster. But that's no justification for such a weak and shady and dodgy agreement like Minsk II. And we should basically think very hard what we can do to replace it, but not in negotiations with Russia, but how we can really help Ukraine more as a European and NATO member. And then by time, like it was in the GDR, there will be unity coming because of the economic success of a Western fully integrated Ukraine. And that's what I hope is the lesson to be learned out of this 2014 and 15 debacles. Thanks a lot.